All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. I'm recording this from a different location. I'm not in the garage. I imagine you can hear a little difference in the sound quality. I'm in a hotel room in New York City, in Manhattan. And I'm in a neighborhood that I'm not usually in. They put me up in Midtown, as some of you know. I'll be working on the Joker movie. I start tomorrow, and I'm not nervous yet, but I'm going to be. I know many of you know this. I know some of you still don't think I've addressed the reality of it properly, given my criticism of superhero movies. But I will stand by my not only my defense of taking this opportunity to do a scene with Robert De Niro and Joaquin Phoenix, but also in defense of this particular movie. It's not what you think. And that's the truth. I went out to a set. Can't tell you where it is, but it was outside the city. That's where they were set up for that day. And I got fitted for my outfit. And I've been going over my lines, and I'm ready. I'm ready in my mind. I don't know what it'll be like to be standing next to Robert De Niro doing a scene. Walking, actually. We're going to be walking. I think I can tell you that. We're going to be walking and doing a scene. I'm going to be walking and talking to Robert De Niro and then standing still and talking to both of them. I can tell you that much. I believe I'm free and clear to say that. I don't think I've let on anything, really. But I imagine tomorrow when I get there, I'll be like, holy shit. But who knows? I don't know. Did I mention who's on the show? Eric Idle is here from Monty Python. There's been a Monty Python week. So, New York. Yeah, I've been coming here. You know, I lived here. I had a big chunk of my life here. And I come here and I always have odd feelings, you know. This is a perfect time of year. Fall on the East Coast, when it gets a little crisp in the air and the sky is clear and the leaves are starting to turn. Some of them have turned. You're starting to just wear that one layer or two layers. It does something to my brain. Gets me into a space, it's not a high feeling, and I don't know really, you know, what to call it, but it's sort of thoughtful. It's a time of reflection. I don't really do what I used to do when I come here, and I don't know how to really stay here more than 3 days. I left for a reason, and I've talked about that before. You know, it gets to be a little overwhelming, New York, and you get to a point where you just got to get out. But so much of my brain is interfaced with this city. I know how to be in New York, but I think I finally sort of figured out why I don't really like staying here more than a few days, when I used to just love it here. And the truth is, it's like nostalgia can be sort of malignant. I'm not that nostalgic a person. I don't really think about the past as a better time, or think that things were necessarily better in the past, or I don't revise things from my past or sort of ruminate on them in a way that makes me feel like my present is no good. I mean, generally, I tend to forget most of what I went through, if anything, and my memories of things, they never tend towards like being better than what they were. They always go the other way, really. But I think that in general, you know, our own personal histories and whatever we've come through and whatever we've gone through sort of define us. And I looked up the word nostalgia. The definition is a sentimental longing or wistful affection for the past, typically for a period or place with happy personal associations. Something done or presented in order to evoke feelings of nostalgia. But then if you go to the origin of nostalgia, it's Greek. It's nostos. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right. I'm not some sort of linguistic person. Nostos, which is return home, and algos, which is pain. And that sort of evolved into homesickness. And then nostalgia evolved into acute homesickness. And I don't know if they got it right, because I think really what's most cathartic to me about the origin is that return home, pain. I think that's more why we don't go back places. Like me, I understand how it evolved into like when you're not home, that there's a pain for not being home. But I just think if we break it down to nostos and algos, is return home, there is pain. You return home and then the pain will come back. So even in the natural evolution of the word to where it becomes homesickness, in that idea of nostalgia is this essence of the trauma of the past. Like I go around this town, I'm like, why does it feel a little haunted? Whatever my life was here, it was a fucking struggle. All of it. I went through a marriage here. I went through my stand-up, early stand-up career here. I went through drugs here. I went through complete chaotic, existential earthquakes of self here. Part of it defined me, but I just started to realize that this sort of overwhelming kind of energy that makes New York amazing, always had this tinge to it, because I was always happy to be here. But what was that tinge? What was that isolating feeling? What was that kind of darkness around the edges outside of it just being New York? Was that, holy shit, I was a chaotic fucking mess when I was here. Just, at all different points in the decade or so that I was here. And I realized, like, oh, that's it. I mean, I'm not nostalgic for any of that. I mean, as cool as it is to come back and kind of walk past the old haunts and everything, that's what they are. They're old haunts for a reason, because they haunted you and they still haunt you. And it's like, if you really put yourself back in that place from your past, it's like, I would never want to fucking be there again. So it's not getting me depressed, because obviously you move through it to a point where you're like, well, I did okay. Even given all of that bullshit, I made it out and I'm alive and things are going okay. But that doesn't mean that performing for four people or sweating alone in my apartment or wondering, what the fuck was going to happen with my life, getting fucked up all the time, full identity crisis of, what am I doing with my life and that stuff. It's all here. Sweaty Marin wanders these streets eternally. And it all comes down to, like, here's New York, but here are those two blocks, man. Here are those four blocks. Here are those two or three clubs. This was your life for years. And you were sweaty and angry and freaked out and terrified and fucking unsure of everything and just barely hanging on. That guy, if I go back to those two blocks or I go back to that area where those three clubs are, I can still feel and see that part of me, that me who I was, just wandering around sweaty and angry and lost and fucking, hanging hopes on nothing. Granted, I got through it, but when I get in it, it's sort of like, oh, okay, that's the darkness. So maybe my realizing this, maybe I should just, what I'm going to do? I think I'm going to go downtown and I'm going to find Sweaty Mark. I'll probably have to wait until it's like 2 a.m. Maybe go over to Veselka, sit down with Sweaty Mark and just go like, dude, you can leave. You don't have to, it worked out. It worked out, Sweaty Mark. So let's get together on this and frame it the right way so you're not nagging at me when I come back here. Yeah, that was that experience. I'm glad I put that together. Return home, pain. Right? So, Eric Idle. This was a great conversation. It was fun having the honor, actually, to talk to John Cleese and Eric Idle. It was an amazing experience. And when I talked to Eric, and I didn't talk too much about John about this specifically, but I remember, man, I remember, do you remember? I mean, I'm 55 now, and I remember when Monty Python was on PBS. That was where you had to watch it. And I remember when I first heard about it and turning that channel over to PBS, which was generally at that point, I guess it was in the 70s and I was young. It was kind of flat. It was not that engaging. I didn't watch Sesame Street. I didn't watch McNeil Lehrer. I didn't, there were news programs on there, but I don't know that I really understood what public broadcasting was, but it was on there. But I remember late at night, you would tune in and those credits, the Terry Gilliam credits, and it was just like, it was fucking mind blowing. It's like, what am I watching? What the fuck is happening? And I was thinking about this alongside of thinking about nostalgia and thinking about when I was younger and thinking about, you know, getting into that space and thinking about sitting in front of that TV set late at night downstairs in the house I grew up in, you know, alone in the dark in front of that TV set, and that Monty Python came on and you were like, what is this? There is nothing like this on any planet except here and now. What is going on? And then it would just unfold. The show would unfold and you're like, what am I watching? What's happening to my brain? It was fucking mind-blowing. And I just really kind of locked into that today when I was thinking about talking to you guys about this. That, like, there was nothing like it. And to this day, there remains, it remains that there's nothing like it. But watching that when it was happening, at the time it was happening, having that weird secret feeling of like, does anybody else know about this? This is insane. What am I watching? That was the beauty of it. And then just taking it in and trying to wrap your brain around it was spectacular. It was an incredible experience. And now I get to talk to one of the guys, another one of the guys. Eric Idle has a book out. It's his memoir, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, is now available wherever you get books. And this was a conversation that happened a few weeks ago in the garage, and had a lovely time. These guys are, they're great. I'd like to talk to Palin. Maybe that can happen. I don't know, but this is me and Eric Idle back in the garage. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. I got your book and I picked, and someone sent me the oral history of David Bowie, and I noticed you weren't in there. You're like one of, did they ask you to do that?
Somebody wrote to me and said, I'm so sorry I didn't talk to you.
Oh, that.
But I don't think they knew we were friends. It wasn't a very broadcast.
Right.
It was just happened, we happened to be friends for quite a long time, actually.
So when did you meet
80s
him?
And, I met him through Bobcat Goldthwait here in the I think 80s.
You met him through Bobcat?
Yes, he was good friends, but he loved comedians.
I had no idea that Bobcat knew him, and I've talked to Bobcat. He's directed my show. He's been on this show a million times, and how did I not know he didn't know Bowie?
Well, I think he introduced us, and then we met in on holiday,
yeah,
in St. Bart's by Lorne Michaels.
Yeah.
And we got on really well. And then we went and stayed with him several times in Switzerland.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we got really good friends. And we went on a couple of cruises with him.
With Bowie?
Yeah.
See, it always surprises me as a fan of people that they just have normal lives.
That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who would have figured?
So you're down in St. Bart's with Lorne Michaels, David Bowie.
Yeah.
But
then his kid was there. My kid was there.
I just interviewed him. Duncan?
Yeah, Duncan. Yeah. I there's a picture of him in the book,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I saw that.
I guess we're on St. No, I don't know where we are on holiday there.
Is it an odd thing, though?
Mystique, perhaps.
That that when you reach a certain level of celebrity, that you sort of have to hang out with the other ones?
I think it becomes neutralized.
Yeah.
I don't think they aren't celebrities. They're
right.
Just people you meet who happen to be in show business.
In the same business you are. Yeah, that makes sense.
Or not even the same business. They're doing music. You know, I'm not in that business. But
you are in that business.
Well, peripherally.
But I mean, it seems like that was the, it almost seems like that was the thing you were most passionate about early on.
early on, when I first came to America, most of my life here was rock and roll. So I was up at night only.
Yeah.
And that was with Harrison and George and people.
When was that? What year are you talking about?
I suppose we're talking 75. We first came here in 73.
With the troupe, with the guys?
Stayed at the Riot House, yes.
Yeah, over on the Hyatt. It's now the Hyatt. Yeah, yes. Next to the Comedy Store.
Well, they called it the Riot House.
Yeah, yeah. It was crazy.
Yeah.
In 73?
Yeah.
Oh, that must have been crazy.
Well, we came out. It was crazy.
All the guys?
All except John, who missed a good time always.
Oh, just his nature?
Well, he was older. You know, I mean, he literally is.
How much older?
Well, he's born in 1939.
Yeah.
So he will be what? Next year he will be 80.
Yeah. That's
is that possible? Yes.
Yeah, next year. Yeah, my dad's
so
80
he's 79
this
year. And I'm only 75.
Yeah.
Oh, so Palin, too. We're the youngest, too.
How was he at Cambridge when you were there if he was 5 years older?
Because after the war, all of the servicemen got a preference to go into Cambridge and Oxford.
Uh-huh.
So he had to wait. His generation had to wait a couple of years. And he might have been liable for national service. But what he did is he went back to his old prep school and taught Latin for 2 years.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I think he told me that. It's just crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's his happiest time. Yeah. So it's even weirder. He's really a teacher, John. I mean, in many good ways.
So 73, you're here. It's all rock and roll?
73,
that was the
we're
first
here.
Trip
it's a,
over?
It's the summer of rock and roll. We came out of touring Canada.
Uh-huh. As the group.
As the group, and that was a rock and roll reaction.
Was that the end of, but that was the end of the TV show, around 73, no?
The TV show was, we were deciding whether to do a fourth series.
Uh-huh.
And on the tour, John announced he was not going to do that. And so he left us at Vancouver, which was the last date.
Yeah.
And we were taken by Neil Bogard, the record company, Buddha Records. So they took us down to L.A.
Yeah.
to do promo because we were only on records here.
Oh,
and people only knew us as a recording. They thought we were like, what's that called? Far Sign Theater. They we just did comedy records.
Well, there were two of them, right? Two records?
I don't know what they released here.
Yeah.
But they were on Buddha, and then we had to do, we did The Tonight Show, we did, you know, various weird promotional things.
And it was, and that's interesting, so the TV show didn't start airing here until when?
I would say it was started in Dallas.
A strange beginning.
Isn't it?
Yeah. On the PBS there.
Dallas PBS, yeah. Ron DeVillier picked it up, it was very cheap from the BBC, and he noticed an immediate spike on Sunday nights.
Yeah.
And he persuaded other stations, including New York, to run it, other PBS stations.
I grew up in New Mexico, and I remember that was where you found it. It was this strange thing to find where, you know, word got out, and you're like, that's on PBS, what is it? And it'd be on late at night, and you'd be sitting there, you're a kid, and you're like, what am I watching? I was like 13.
And for about 25, 30 years, that was it. And that was so great for us because it ran, and nobody cared.
Yeah.
And it was on. People could find it in every city.
Yeah.
All over America. It didn't hit ratings or anything because it's on PBS.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't cut it.
Yeah.
And they didn't have commercial breaks.
Right.
So it was just a perfect home. We wouldn't have been there but for that.
And it's interesting because that cultivated a true cult audience. I mean, people became very dedicated to it. It was a unique find. You know, who would watch PBS, and you had this whole generation of people that were discovering something that almost no one knew about.
That was the experience of Python. People sort of discovered it like a cult.
Yeah,
and it was a cult viewing. And ooh, did we know this? And you know, when we ever did a tour, they would come out and they'd find other fans at the concert with them.
Right,
and
right.
That was like news to them. There
converts.
Other people.
Oh, I see. So they'd go to the show and they're like, oh, you like them too.
Right. The other people. Yeah, you know, my gosh, I thought it was just my little secret.
Who did I talk to? It was Roger Waters, I think, who I talked to, of a generation of people that were born, you know, during World War II. And sort of the effect that has, because that's one big difference between Americans and Europeans is that Europeans were, they got the shit bombed out of them. And it was a real thing. And that's something we have no real awareness of here.
No.
And you remember it? How old were you?
I remember the sound of the sirens. I was about 2.5 when the war ended in 45.
Oh, young.
I was young, but but terror, it communicates itself very quickly. So it was an experience. And then after the post-war, it was very bleak because we had rationing till I was 10 or 11.
Because it was rubble forever.
It was rubble everywhere.
And your father didn't die in the war.
My father died hitchhiking home for Christmas from the RAF.
And he made it through the war.
Made it through the war from 1941 in the back, you know, in the Lancaster bomber.
Wow.
But he was in transport command, mercifully. But, yeah. And then was sort of killed in a road accident on the way home for Christmas.
Oh, my God.
I know.
It's But you don't remember that.
No, I don't remember that.
But you remember his absence.
I think so, yes. I mean, they were always absent because they were in the war.
Right.
So they were away. You don't remember. But, I mean, I have pictures and his diaries and little things. It's very sweet. Afterwards, you put these things together, you know.
And do you have siblings?
No.
You were only child?
Only child, yes.
Wow. So when after your father passed, I mean, did you just grow up with your mother?
My mother went into sort of kind of depression, and it was so I grew up with what I call my gran and my pop, who I think were her uncle and aunt.
Yeah.
And I was in Manchester, and they were very loving and nice to me.
So the depression lasted a lifetime?
No, well, yeah, on and off it did, actually. I think she was bipolar. But eventually then she got a job as a nurse in Wallasey, which is the other side of the Mersey from Liverpool. And I went to school there with her for the first time at five.
Uh-huh. And then you didn't stay there, though.
Well, we were there 2 years, and then she got an offer from the RAF Benevolent Fund to put me into this boarding school, which paid for the entire education.
Oh, so they did that. That's how you got into Oxford as well, or Cambridge as
because
well.
Because of that, really, indirectly, 12 years later. But all the boys I was at school with had no fathers.
But some of them remembered them passing, or like, yeah. So
I
you
don't
capture,
think so. We'd have been kids.
Yeah, in the book, you sort of talk about how they were all crying and you didn't. Yeah.
Well, that was early on. You're seven. It's a bit of a shock
to be taken away.
So suddenly you're in the middle of this sort of awful place. You know?
It was awful.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was awful. The senior school was awful. We were in a dormitory in the senior school, which was 100 yards long.
Right.
With a bed every 3 feet.
Oh, my God.
Like, yeah, no, not great.
No. Not much privacy, too.
No privacy at all. And a lot of bullying and quite a lot of beating. You could be beaten by the prefects.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So that was okay then?
Endemic. And
yeah.
then the masters could beat you with canes.
Really?
It was their privilege, yes.
Did that happen to you a lot?
A lot.
Why, because you were a smartass?
Well, you could put it that way. I mean, I was once beaten for silent insolence. What chance does that give you? I didn't say anything. Yeah, but you looked.
We sensed what you were thinking.
Yes.
And when did you, like, with the British, there's the entire comedic sensibility is different, I believe, than here in the States. And there's a whole history of comedy that I learn about in bits and pieces. So when you were younger, at that age, what were your first experiences with the idea of being funny, or what was entertaining to you?
Well, we didn't have much entertainment. What we got into most of all was rock and roll. So when Elvis came and saved our lives,
yeah.
So we had little transistor radios. We actually built crystal sets first to listen to the music on the radio.
And so you're clever kids.
Well, we were smart.
Yeah.
We figured out, you had all this time.
Yeah.
You got 14 weeks of school.
Right.
I mean, it's just endless. And then other people grew up and had teenage lives, you know, they're going out and dating and dancing.
Yeah.
But we're stuck in this place. So we listened a lot to music, rock and roll. It was very, very important.
It was life-saving.
Really
something was
life-saving.
Happening.
Totally. Elvis totally saved our lives.
Really? Do you remember the first time you heard it? But
absolutely. I was in a cat. It was a Heartbreak Hotel. And it was 57, I think, and I was at this sort of holiday camp called Butlins, where you went for 2 weeks, and it was quite fun. But all the girls, they were dancing and jitterbugging to that.
To Elvis?
Yeah, Elvis.
Broke it open, unleashed the primal desire
Absolutely.
Of all the children.
He seemed to be on our side. He seemed to be talking to us.
And were you playing music at that time?
I was in a skiffle group, so a folk group. And so I started off by playing harmonica.
Can you still play?
Chuck Berry, Brownie McGee, and
Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee.
Pick a bale of cotton. I'd do all those things. And then we did sort of black protest songs, because I think we associated somehow being all white in Wolverhampton at about 3,000 miles from the Deep South.
Right.
Maybe 5,000 miles. We somehow associated with those protests.
The idea of repression and oppression and not being free to do what you want to do.
Totally. So it was between that and British war films where they were sort of escaping from Colditz. So we, our school we called Colditz. It was like the Colditz.
Right.
And you had to break out, always climbing over the walls.
So before Elvis was, there was a folk thing happening. I mean, do you remember? Because it seemed like that you grew up in this prime era of upheaval.
Yes.
Social upheaval. So like folk was popular, and that was that, did you see yourself like, I'm going to do this?
No. It was fun playing guitar. We had a guitarist, a banjo player, and I was the harmonica player. And then eventually at 14, I got myself a guitar.
Yeah.
And started to try and learn, you know, the basic chords and play songs and things and that.
Yeah. And what was the, at that time, the comedic influences? Like what were you listening to outside of Elvis? You were listening to the radio. There must have been...
No.
Well,
there were great shows on the radio, but they were always on when we were doing prep, which was like in the evening, just for change.
Right.
We'd do 2 hours of prep, which means you go into the school, you know, and your classroom, and then do hours of homework.
Yeah.
Compulsory watched homework.
Yeah, but you talk a little in the book about, you know, being somewhat, that you were a legacy of performers. Somewhere in your genealogy, there were circus performers or brought...
Oh, well, that's true, though. That's my great-great-grandfather was a circus ringmaster in the 1880s and 1890s.
And did you go to the circus?
I was taken to the circus at 5 in Bellevue, Manchester, by my pop, who was looking after me. And the clowns treated us like royalty. It was unbelievable because his name was Bertrand.
Yeah.
And this guy was called Bertrand in the 1880s.
Your great-grandfather.
And he was famous.
Yeah.
A famous ringmaster.
And the clowns...
And the clowns were very respectful. And, you know, you're terrified of clowns when you're little. But we went backstage. So that's kind of cool, circus royalty.
Were you terrified of clowns?
Yeah, they're kind of scary. Because they're anarchic, you know, especially in real live performances.
Anarchic.
Very much so.
I guess I never thought about it that way, but that's true. They have this sort of like the freedom to do that.
Absolutely. And they mess around with the other performers and they pretend to throw buckets of water over the audience. And
that's true, yeah.
They're more fun, actually, in real life like that, in bunches, I think.
Yeah, groups of clowns are more fun. An isolated clown could be sad.
Very sad. It becomes turns into a bobcat with some kind of strange agenda to kill you, I think.
Yeah. But I guess I never really processed that. And you call it, like, Monty Python's Flying Circus. Where'd that come from?
I mean, it was a very strange amalgamation. But only afterwards did I realize I was also in a circus.
Yeah.
I mean, that struck me as being really strange. And then I looked into my great-great-grandfather, and found he was also a comedian when he started. Before he became a ringmaster, he was a comedian.
Like doing the equivalent of pre-vaudeville, I guess. We have burlesque houses.
I would say musical vaudeville. That he was in Folkestone in one of the censuses. These him and another guy are staying there, and they're listed as comedians.
Really? I wonder if they were a team.
I think they were.
Yeah?
No, they were. They were, but I don't know what they did.
Yeah.
No historical
record of that? No videotape, no audio tape, no transcripts?
This is 1825.
I know.
Yeah. This very ancient cracked record where they're doing mainly visual comedy. What a pity you can't see that.
But did you, I have to assume that living that kind of life and that sort of, it sounds dark. It sounds like there was a darkness to it, that it must have been a relief to laugh, I would imagine.
Laughter was very good because it was our rebellion, and you laughed at the authority, and you subverted authority. We learned to climb over the walls and go to the off license and buy beer and find make girls and meet girls and all the good decent things.
The things you learn when you're in confinement.
Well, yes, because it is sort of halfway between being in the military and being in prison.
Was that the agenda of the school, to get you into the military?
I don't think so. I think they were kindly disposed. I mean, there were all these sort of semi-orphans that the RAF were paying for.
Right.
And because they're sort of widows. So it was very hard for single women to have a job and to bring up a kid from 7 to 18.
Yeah,
it's very,
for
very
sure.
hard.
Yeah.
So I think they were being philanthropic.
Yeah.
And we got a decent education. I mean, I discovered, you know, I got on to Cambridge.
Yeah. What were your interests when you were at the boarding school? I mean, like, because it seems like, you know, when you look at Python and you look at the work you did, even in music and stuff, that there is a historical tradition to it, that, you know, certainly the movies at Python, the stuff you guys dealt with was pretty deep stuff, lofty stuff.
Well, I had two things. I had two toys, one of which is my gran gave me a typewriter.
Yeah.
So I started to write stories.
Yeah.
And that was an escape.
Yeah.
And the other thing was my guitar, which is a fantastic mode of escape. And I suppose the third thing I would say is I learned to read.
Yeah.
And that's an enormous escape if you're in a huge, crowded community of boys and things, you know. And, you know, we played football and messed around and played cricket. And, you know, it wasn't all bleak.
Right.
I think the overall art of it was bleak because there's no emotional support.
Right. Yeah, I guess emotional guidance or someone to look up to. I mean, when you don't have a father, it's a big void in terms of like, well, who am I going to be? Who is going to be my role model?
But also your mother isn't there, so there are no hugs.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
no kind of, oh, well, yeah. you must feel blue. Yeah, no, yeah. no, shut up, get on, go over there. You know, it's like...
yeah.
So it's a sort of hard... I think it was a tough environment, but good if... I learned a lot of really valuable things.
Did you learn how to accept hugs eventually?
Eventually, I have persuaded women to let me hug them. Oh, let them hug me, yes. Yeah. No, of course, after you left, it was just like a pursuit.
Right.
You know, desperate pursuit.
Yeah. And so Love me, somebody.
Yeah, and then you have to learn how to treat, you know, how to actually appreciate women for being women, which takes a lot longer.
Well, yeah, culturally, it's a big issue now.
Yes.
They're not just things we play with, they're human beings.
But, I mean, you have to learn that.
I think that's true.
Nobody teaches you. And also, I mean, you've got co-ed, so that at least you know
they're around.
Go with them.
Right,
you know,
right,
see
right.
They're there.
Yeah, yeah. Try to talk to them.
We had to climb over schools and roofs and things to get towards them.
So Oxford, you went to Cambridge,
yes.
Sorry. I get the two confused. Is one better than the other? Are they both equally as...
No, they have different kind of personalities. I mean, if you look at Python, Michael Palin and Terry Jones went to Oxford. John Cleese, me, and Graham Chapman were at Cambridge.
Uh-huh.
And I think about Oxford are very much more... They're prissier. All the politicians in England come out of Oxford,
uh-huh.
always. So they're much more controlling. Cambridge is much more flamboyant. We produce spies.
Right.
Basically, spies from the Russians were all Cambridge. And they're either gay or extremely flamboyant and drunk.
Yeah.
And so there's much more enjoyment of Cambridge. And show business is tolerated. It's kind of an okay thing to do to be successful.
In Cambridge.
Whereas in Oxford, you sort of have to apologize for it and write diaries forever. So there's Alan Bennett. And, we're not supposed to be very into showbiz much, you know.
Except politics is just like not entertaining show business.
Well, politics is, I don't quite know what politics is, but I think there's a degree they do at Oxford they don't do at Cambridge. This is why they all go to.
But that's funny that the prerequisite for spying is flamboyance and drinking and the tolerance of show business. I guess there is a lot of acting and role playing when you're a professional spy.
There was a famous one, I think his name was Burgess, and he was in America, he's English, and he's in America, and he was an extraordinary alcoholic, and every night he got drunk and would tell everybody he was a Russian spy. And they went, yeah, shut the fuck up.
It's like, he was saying that even
he
after...
He was a Russian spy. He ran away, eventually escaped.
That was the that was his big front, is that he was so upfront about it that people didn't believe it. It's kind of genius.
I don't think it was a clever double bluff. He was just drunk.
So when you get there, how did that... So the state, how does it work? So you got a scholarship for being... A good student?
Yeah, in those days, you get accepted by the college. There are 23 colleges at Cambridge, and a college will take you on. And then
23 colleges in different places? There's not
in the
one...
same town.
Okay, okay.
You know, so the different colleges in the university.
So there's an engineering college, there's English...
No, they're not just... No, you're in a college, and that houses you and ties you, but you could be doing maths, you could be doing art, you could be doing architecture.
Right.
It doesn't matter what you're doing. And then you go and study in the university place for whatever you're doing.
Right, I get it.
And so...
What did you get accepted to do?
English, which is nothing at all.
It's important. I mean,
you just read. I didn't do much except do comedy. I actually stumbled into comedy very early on. I met John Cleese in my second term.
Yeah.
And I auditioned and I did a college review. And my first piece I did ever publicly was a piece he'd written.
Really?
Yeah.
So, but you weren't, like, I guess in terms of, like, when I look at some of the lyrics of the songs, you weren't in any way obsessed with the, you know, the poetry of Alexander Pope or Swift or the funnier Shakespeare, like those kind of, like, you know, historical satirists.
Sure, I still am. I love Swift. I love Pope. It was nice to read English literature. But
even Chaucer was hilarious.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the thing was, the thing about English, studying English, is you don't have to go to the lectures. You can read the book in 3 minutes. Everything he's going to say at the lecture, you could have skimmed through.
Right.
And really, they're interested in what you think.
Right.
So, but you have to read the text and then respond to it.
So what is the trajectory assumed of somebody studying English at Cambridge? Was it like here, like you just sort of like, well, that's a degree I have. Now I work at a photo mat or a copy store or what?
I guess you go on to be a teacher. I don't honestly know what. I guess you could be a journalist. You could be a writer.
Right. I have an English degree and I'm in my garage talking to Eric Idle.
And I'm here in the garage with my English degree talking to you. So, you know, it's nice because I would find that at Cambridge, everybody just studying everything else had already read the same books I was reading.
Right.
But they were becoming architects.
Right.
And mathematicians.
They actually had the foresight to create a life for themselves that had some security, perhaps.
But it turned out it was a good thing to be, because I didn't have anything particular to do. So I went into rep for about 6 minutes and then I got into writing comedy.
What's rep?
Repertory theatre.
Oh, okay.
We did Oh, What a Lovely War, Leicester rep. And then, but basically.
While you were at Cambridge?
After, just leaving.
Oh, so when you're at Cambridge, you meet Cleese and you meet who, Graham?
Graham had gone down, but I met him at the end of that year. I met Michael Palin and Terry Jones at the Edinburgh Festival.
Right, but when you were at Cambridge and started doing comedy, because I talked to Sacha Baron Cohen, who I believe could not get into.
He was turned down.
From the Footlights Club?
The Footlights.
Now, the Footlights, this is sort of like important for, but he went on to study clowning with a master. I forget the guy's
name.
Right. But I think it was a sort of a deciding factor in his comedic career was that he was turned down from Footlights. And what was Footlights a historical club that had been there forever?
1883.
Uh-huh.
And
what was the idea of it?
I was just a review society, a comedy society, and it had its own club room. So it was a little stage at one end and a bar at the other end, which opened at 10:30 at night, and you could stay as late as you wanted. So that was our social life.
Yeah.
They did lunches. So from about
free
my
drinks?
Free
drinks? No, you got paid.
No.
Yeah.
But drink?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, the pub's closed at 10.
Right.
So, you know, when we opened at 10:15, it was really good, you know. So you just went on. But it was very social. And then I got to watch all these people like John Cleese and Bill Hardy and Tim McTaylor, all performing and doing stuff.
Yeah.
And that's the only way you can learn comedy.
Yeah. And what was the thing that he wrote that you performed? Like, how did you get in? Do you have to audition? What is the process?
Yes, you have to write a piece and audition, which I did. And I got in with Jonathan Lynn, who's a film director, Johnny Lynn. He did Nuns on the Run, and he did Vinny, My Cousin Vinny.
Oh, yeah, that's a big movie.
Yep.
And what did you write? Do you remember?
I wrote a sketch, but the one I did with John was actually based on what's called BBC BC.
Yeah.
And it was a BBC newsreader.
Yeah.
Good even, here is the news.
Yeah.
And it was like, and I did the weather forecast.
Right.
There have been, over the last few days, it's been a bit rough. There's been plague of frogs, lizards, locusts,
the apocalyptic boils, weather forecast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now moving in from the northeast.
Yeah.
Frogs.
Yeah. You know? right. Yeah.
And after that, death of all the firstborn.
Yeah.
Sorry about that, Egypt.
So you went biblical.
It was a biblical news. BBC BC.
So that got you in.
That got me to know, learn. Cleese came across to me and was introduced, and he asked me to join the Footlights, and I never heard of it. So he said, no, just come and audition. So we did, and we got in.
Because I watched some old Peter Cook stuff. And Dudley
Cook.
Moore.
Yep.
And it just seemed like, you know, the way he approached characters was something like the way you guys did. Were you guys contemporaries or was he older?
Peter had gone down about 4 years, but his voice was everywhere.
Everybody talked like this because he's E.L. Wistie. I'd like to be a miner, but I don't have the Latin. I did the mining exam. They said, what is your name? And I got 50% on that.
There is this weird kind of like tradition. It's because I watched some of the Goon Show, And there was just really some relentless satirizing between classes.
Yes.
That, you know, that like, you know, the Irish took a big hit on some of the Goon Show stuff. You know?
Well, they come out of the army. Those Goon Show people came out of the army.
Yeah.
Well, Peter Sellers and Harry Secombe, all that lot. And then after them came Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and John, and they would be on the fringe. And they were the first satirists.
Yeah.
And they mocked the Prime Minister and the Army and the Queen. And
was that happening when you were in college?
That's when just before I got there, 1962, I saw that show and it changed my life.
Really?
Yes. I laughed so hard. I couldn't believe you were allowed to laugh at these things.
Right.
Because you weren't allowed to laugh at these things openly in school.
Right. Or even say it, especially in a government-run school.
Not in front of the grown-ups.
Authority. Yeah.
Well, you said everything, but you didn't.
So the mid-60s was a time where, like, a lot of that stuff broke open, right?
It was a time of satire in England. 63, 64, there was a show called That Was the Week That Was on television,
right,
which was David Frost. And so that brought down a government. It actually changed the Conservative government. The power of satire on television.
And what else was going on? Like, because I've talked to, I talked to musicians, and it seemed like that in London at that time in the 60s, there was just so much going on with theater, with music, like, you know, everything was like changing very quickly.
It was a renaissance.
Yeah.
And it was because there was nothing there. There's bomb sites. There aren't another generation of people who are on television. There wasn't any television.
Right.
There aren't another people who are comedians. They were in the army.
Yeah.
So we came onto an open playing field and created art.
The young people.
The young people. All of the misfits were sent off to art college.
Yeah.
And they all became rock and roll.
Right.
All the Who, the Beatles, the Stones largely, all were in art colleges. And they came out of art colleges.
Yeah.
And they were the sort of bad boys. And so they started early. But we were the same generation. And our lot went into, you know, eventually television and radio.
Oh, that's wild. And it's sort of interesting that all those guys, like when you talk about, and this is just me talking about music, when you bring up Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, which is a fairly esoteric reference, that those records came through in Britain. That, like, there must have been some premium put on, like, where'd you get that record? Like, it was must have been sort of difficult to get those records.
Well, I think that was folky. That was the folk world. It was kind of a bit hip for a little while.
Yeah,
it was folk.
Right.
People wore.
But even the blues records, like the thrill of getting those, because all those bands, The Who and The Stones and the Beatles, not to the same degree, were guys that were influenced by American blues, turned it inside out, and then resold it to America. It was kind of genius.
I think the answer to that question is they came in on the banana boats into Liverpool.
Uh-huh.
And they came from the West Indies, and they came from America. Liverpool's a port.
Yeah.
Like Hamburg's a port.
So the records did.
So the records came with sailors.
Yeah.
They brought them in
and
they liked it, liked the music, and that the music spread that way.
Yeah. It kind of blows me away what was going on there. And theater was like crazy then too, right?
Theater was angry young men. They were protesting. It changes over from being rather polite theater of Noel Coward.
Yeah.
And that goes and becomes very dated suddenly. And there's a play called Look Back in Anger by John Osborne.
Right. That's
which
it.
Which changes everything.
Right.
And so they were known as the angry young men.
And that happened simultaneously.
That's at the same time,
the rock and roll,
just as we're teenagers and early 20s. Yes.
So like now you have this open, it's like the Wild West, you know, for comedy. Like, you know, that the floodgates have been open.
And there's nobody stopping you getting in.
Yeah.
You're in fact, we
they
were
need
encouraged
you.
To come into television.
Yeah,
Frost
yeah.
gave us all jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
As writers.
And how did you meet Jones and Palin if they were at Oxford?
Because I was part of the Edinburgh Festival, Cambridge Footlights, and they were part of the Oxford Review. So we went to check them out.
So when you get to Edinburgh, which is still a festival, it's the same festival every year, the one that's still going on.
Except
now.
Except it's huge now.
I know.
And everybody looks for comedians. But Beyond the Fringe refers to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe.
Yeah.
That's where they came out of.
Yeah.
And so we're only a few years later. There's a tradition for Oxford and Cambridge to send reviews there.
Yeah.
And we were part of that.
And that's where you met them.
That's where I went to see them and where I saw Palin first performing and Jonesy first performing. And, you know, you go and say hello.
Yeah.
You're the same age. You're doing the same things.
So funny. They were so funny. Palin was very funny.
He was hilarious. I mean, I saw him performing for the first time.
Yeah.
And I never forget the sketch. He is really funny.
Yeah. What was the nature of the
sketch?
Well,
he came on stage and he was playing an old performer. And he said, you know, hello, every people. I'd like, very nice to be here. And he looked down and there's this big present beside him. He said, oh, what's this? And he looks down and it says, oh, to Mikey from the audience with love. Oh, every people. Oh, my gosh, I'm so touched.
Yeah.
I thought I was too old and out of touch and nobody cared about me anymore. And I was, well, I don't know what to do. I can only sing my biggest hit, When Love Breaks Your Heart in a Million Tiny Pieces. When love... And the box blew up.
It was such a great joke. And he played it so well. It was just the emotion of it all, you know. So, like, did you start writing together shortly after that? Or
They're at Oxford, and then we're at Cambridge, so we finish our courses, and then we find ourselves all writing for The Frost Report, which is a BBC
You just
show.
All got hired.
And so we're all hired. Yeah. We're writing. He's writing with Terry. I was writing a bit, I think, with Graham.
It's so funny, in my memory, I don't know, like, I didn't know him, Frost, as a, as a comedian.
Well, he's not very funny. He wasn't very good, but he was a good host, and he was very good at knowing who was funny.
Right. So
he would bring people in. Like, he gave us all jobs.
Right.
So, I'm 23, I'm writing on this big hit show on the BBC.
And then, like, so that, because, like, I think one of the things that, you know, Python, outside of just comedically, was revolutionary, was because of the structure of lack of structure. The movement, you know, from sketch to sketch, piece to piece, it was, it obviously wasn't random, but it didn't abide by any sort of set structure. You just kind of flowed lyrically almost.
We got rid of punchlines.
Yeah.
But don't forget, we'd written for all these other shows.
Which
other
ones?
We were professional writers.
The
two Ronnies, Tommy Cooper. Everybody had written for various other big English comedians.
Didn't you write a children's show for a while?
And then we were on a TV show called Do Not Adjust Your Set.
Who was? All of you?
I was asked to do it, and I asked for Mike and Terry to be with me.
Yeah.
And then Terry Gilliam eventually came and joined us.
And that's where you met Terry Gilliam?
Yes, he just came in.
On the kids' show?
On the kids' show, and Mike and Terry hated him. And I said, no, he's got something.
You he's know, American.
He's American.
Yeah.
What the hell do we need this American for?
Yeah.
And I said, well, he can draw. He's funny. He's, he's very weird. He's cute. So so I persuaded them.
To bring in Terry.
And then, absolutely.
And so that I think that seems to make good sense to me that you all sort of started to explore possibilities on a children's show.
It was nice we had a children's show because we decided we wouldn't talk down to children. We'd just do what we found funny. But we couldn't use blue,
right?
Which is also a very good discipline.
Yeah,
it's so easy to just be rude.
Yeah,
for a shock.
So you had to sweeten it.
It wasn't never sweet. It's kind of in your face. It's still a bit sort of odd.
Yeah,
and we won lots of awards. It was very popular, and then it was on at 5:25, and so a lot of people would come home from work early to watch it.
Grown ups. Yeah,
including John and Graham, who were writing movies for Peter Sellers at the time,
they
would stop and watch our show.
They what movies did they write for Peter? Magic Christian?
Yes.
The Terry Southern bit.
John's in that.
Yeah.
And so is Graham, I think, in a scene. They were rewriting Terry Southern things and maybe some other things for Frost. There was a Peter Cook one, The Rise and Rise of Michael Rimmer. They might have been involved in that. There were serious, you know, script writers.
But they locked into the children's show because they're like
they watched the children's show because John said it was the funniest thing on television. So they wanted to just laugh.
What were you doing that was different than what might have been thought of as a children's show?
I think it was just more in your face kind of Python thing. It was kind of silly.
Yeah.
It was very silly.
Yeah.
And then we had this group called the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, who were on every week. It was from an art school, really weird group.
Yeah.
And I think that the whole thing was very sort of, it was kind of funny. It was only about 25 minutes.
And the kids loved it.
The kids loved it. And then the adults loved it too, which is, and we won awards and...
That's an amazing feat. Well, culturally, that's it seems to be the drive of the movie industry now. It's like, if you can get kids and grown-ups to enjoy the thing, then it's good. Adventure Time is a lot of the animated stuff's like that now.
Right.
Have you ever had, you know, people who watched it as a kid, who went on to creative professions, come up to you and say, like, that changed my entire view of things?
People remember that show of a certain age.
Yeah.
But then there's Python, and then there's, I mean, you know, it depends what age you come in.
Yeah.
You know, what you tune into. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore had their own series called Not Only But Also, and that was really funny.
Yeah.
The BBC wiped it.
Why?
Save tape.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's like 2-inch Ampex. They wiped it.
Yeah.
So only the bits that remain are on film. Because they shot some film bits, like the Leaping Nuns of Norwich.
Yeah.
Which is Peter on a trampoline, bobbing up and down. Yeah, the Leaping Nuns of Norwich. Very, very funny. He was hilarious. I knew him. I loved him. He's adorable. He was unique because he was the only one who did improv. Nobody else. The improv wasn't existing in our day.
It was all scripted.
But Peter could improvise an entire cabaret.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And he was unique in that way.
He was very unique in that way. And everybody did his voices and he went on television. And yeah, he was groundbreaking.
And did you eventually have a relationship with him?
Yeah, yeah. We got to be great friends. We were on a film, Yellowbeard, where we had a lot of fun. We went up the Nile together with John Cleese and Stephen Fry. We had this great trip up the Nile.
You went up the Nile?
Yeah.
Just as a vacation, an adventure?
To celebrate his 100th wedding with his wife, who he now doesn't refer to, took
not
about
in a good way.
40 friends yeah. up the Nile for 3 weeks. On a boat.
On a boat.
It's an amazing time. So it's like, you know, you got Peter Cook every night to make you laugh. You got William Goldman was on there. You know,
really?
Stephen Fry would sit on the deck every day and read this children's book called Bunter on the Nile at tea time. I mean, it was just great.
Oh, that's amazing.
That was amazing. Plus, Egypt is the most fantastic place. Have you ever been?
No.
Oh, my God. It's like if you go down into those tombs, they've only just been revealed. So it's like fresh paint on the walls.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Well, because they finished and they killed them. You know, but they sealed it. So it is an extraordinary, it's like alien world.
I can't. Yeah. And that was what year was that?
And then 90, possibly 3.
Oh, wow. And
92, perhaps.
I can't imagine what it's like. I guess you can just go see it.
But I think there's certain parts are dangerous still, but I think it's just the most wonderful trip I ever took.
And how far did you go? Where did it start?
We went all the way up from the, Cairo.
Yeah.
And then we got on the boat there, and we went all the way up to the first cataract where there's a dam.
Yeah.
And so then we got on a bus, and that's 2 hours further up. You go to Abu Simbel, which is a lake flooded. They flooded it, but they raised this temple up 300 feet.
Yeah.
So it's still, the sun still hits on the longest day and hits the pharaoh through that cave.
You know? Oh, so, wow.
And it's, yeah, no, it is an extraordinary place to visit.
What do you make of it, like mystically?
It's 5,000 years ago.
It's crazy, right?
It's very long time ago, and they're building these pyramids.
Yeah.
And
are you a superstitious, mystical person in any way? Do you think that they're
not so much?
Yeah.
No, but I think it's very interesting. This is our early cultures, you know, and what they're doing. And they're doing hieroglyphic writing. We only really recently discovered how to read what they were writing.
And hieroglyphics are back with emojis. You know, it's funny, full circle.
I noticed that too. Yeah. We're going backwards.
Yeah, we're going to be completely primitive, but completely equipped with technology. Yeah, that's what's happening.
There's a thing on the web, you can actually translate your email into Egyptian. And I did it. I sent it to people. It's good, isn't it?
Yeah. And they were probably like, do I have these on my phone? How come I don't know what it's saying?
Dear Pharaoh.
Yeah. So how did the Python deal happen?
The Python deal happened because John and Graham were watching our show. And John had been offered a show for the BBC, a late night show, on a Sunday night where there wasn't a show.
Yeah.
And I don't think he wanted to do it with Graham alone, and he didn't want to be a star himself. So he wanted Michael Palin. So he talked to Michael, and Michael, we'd been offered another show, and so we all met together. So it's like a strange mix of the 1948 show meets Do Not Adjust Your Set.
Yeah.
And so we said, oh, well, we'll just do this show until our studio's ready to do the other show we're going to do, which is 9 o'clock on ITV for 3/4 hour.
Yeah.
So we never got to that.
Right.
But so it's like they didn't stay. And we went to the BBC. They said, what do you want to do? And we said, don't know. Yeah. And they said, you're going to have music? Maybe. Yeah, you're going to have film? Oh, film. Film's a good idea. Yeah. We'll have film.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, just go away and make 13.
Yeah.
That's what they said.
Yeah.
And they didn't care. They didn't watch us.
How much of their culture, because you know, you watch a lot of Python, and yeah, it's sort of timeless, but there was a lot going on that was pretty radical. I mean, was it happening around you, or were you guys so insulated?
Well, I mean, I'd been in London, I think, since 65. So yeah. I've been living there, you know, and then was 66, and then the Beatles, and then there was the Summer of Love.
Did you go see 67. The Beatles?
I never saw the Beatles when I was working for Frost. George came on and was doing TM, Transcendental Meditation.
Oh, so at that point.
Stuff.
Is that where you met him?
No, I didn't meet him till about after the Beatles. I met him in 75 here in Hollywood, the screening of the Holy Grail at the old Directors Guild. But, you know, we weren't really part of rock and roll. I mean, we sort of...
But the culture was very permissive creatively, right? I mean...
For us in television, it was totally.
Right.
And we got to make... there was no time slot. There was nothing on television at 10:30. So that's for the start. Second is, it's on late at night, nobody's watching, and we were in color by 3 months.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would look really dated.
Right.
And then more importantly, nobody told us what to do, and we didn't know what to do, so we just did it anyway.
Yeah. And you just figured out, how did this structure unfold? How did you decide
We had lots of conversations, we couldn't agree on anything, so we just started to write it. And then we would just start to put things on a board. You say, well, we're doing 13 shows, well, that's a bit like that one, so let's move it over here, or put things together. I think the fortuitous thing is we got Gilliam.
Yeah.
And Gilliam does all these links.
Yeah, the weird
like
animated
that
links.
Weird, very peculiar, interesting art style.
Yeah.
It frames it all. And it makes it look like it knows what it has some shape.
Right.
And I think that's a very fortuitous thing.
And then you would just like, I think the thing that I always remember is that, you know, in between sketches, you would just cut to just beats of like maybe crazy, I like to bang bricks together, you know, like just these moments.
Right.
That would just kind of recur for no reason. There was, because in my mind, in American comedy, there's no real tradition of absurdism that is as defined as some of the stuff you did. And I think that seems to come from England.
Yes, there was absurd theatre. There's the Albert, the Mayles brothers. There's an absurd tradition and a nonsense tradition from Edward Lear, you know, going on.
Yeah.
But ours was, I think, because we could. Right. We were fucking about. You know, it's like...
It wasn't intellectual.
Well,
it was just...
We don't want to be mistaken for a show that says, and now something completely different, and then play a music song.
Right.
So we adapted their very slogan and turned it against them.
Right.
So I think we like to play with our audience.
Yeah.
This will screw them up. It's like the three-sided record.
Yeah.
Don't tell them. Just let them play. Here, you'll love this side.
Yeah, yeah.
What the hell? Yeah. You know, people are seriously disturbed by that. They still haven't recovered from the shock of not finding the record side.
Yeah. It's so weird, the sort of things that, as I think about it now, when I was watching it when I was 13 or whatever, the stuff that sticks in your mind, you know, the Sam Peckinpah Film Festival. That was insane. As a kid, you know, with no fingers and the bleed.
Right. It's Sam Peckinpah's Salad Days.
Yeah.
And there was this innocuous Julian Slade musical called Salad Days. Where anyone for tennis.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's all very jolly. All very 20s.
Yeah.
And then with Sam Peckinpah films it.
Yeah.
The tennis racket's thrown, it cuts somebody's head off and there's blood everywhere, you know. I think we just pushed each other. If you're in a gang and nobody else is in charge, you go, and you don't want to do anything that's been done.
Right.
That's the other thing. So you are.
That drives, that's
you're
important.
You're advancing it a little bit because, that's a bit obvious. That's a bit too Ronnie's. We'll sell it to them if the sketch is a bit obvious. So,
right.
But I think, you know, just putting in things like Gilliam stands there with a ferret through his head as a Viking, says, however. And then you move on. You go, what is that? But it's...
And you don't need to answer that question.
No.
Right.
But it thrills people at home because they're not seeing people do that.
Well, I think that was, like, if anything speaks to the time and the freedom you had, the idea of not doing anything that's happened before, it creatively is profound. Like, you know, like, and you guys were able to do it.
I think we had the opportunity and we did use it.
Was it always a fight?
I mean, no. I mean, it's a fight because you want your material on.
Right.
And we would argue about whether the chair should be a comfy chair or a straight back chair or a hard back chair very seriously.
Yeah.
But it's because you care about your picture of what may be funniest. So we did, you know, we argued entirely all the time about whether the material is good enough, where it should stop here,
And I think that's healthy.
Sure,
of course. Like,
yeah.
And great criticism.
Yeah.
You get great criticism. People are saying, you know, I thought for the first page that was really funny.
Yeah.
But it stopped being funny. So let's us, you know, we'd move them around or we'd just, you know, together we'd all barnstorm the thought.
So it was like by aggressive committee.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't... there were no emotions involved.
No, right.
It was like people were
British
very serious.
The British were better at that.
Better at no emotions. Yeah, yeah. They've gone all sort of touchy-feely now. I blame Diana. You know, once they started caring about some upper-class git, running into a war with an Arab in Paris. You know, you've got to, it's all over for the British. They're just the same as everybody else. Bring out your hankies, you know.
Yeah. That was the end of it.
That was, for me, the end of it. But yeah. I was here.
Yeah, yeah. You'd gotten out.
Yes, I've learned.
You saw it coming.
A tougher world of America, where there's no sympathy for people just because they're sick or poor.
Yeah, on any level.
On any level at all.
So there was no emotions involved, but there was competition and just sort of you're constantly hard on yourselves to do the best product, basically.
I believe so. And that's why John left after the third series, because he thought we were beginning to repeat ourselves.
Well,
and he'd had enough.
And
he was quite right. And off he went and did Fawlty Towers.
Yeah.
And we did a mini series, half a series. And then I left because I said, look, it's not the same without John. The tension's
so
were good.
Were you upset when John left? Was the rest of the crew like, why would you do this? We got a good thing going.
I think we were disappointed in various levels. Graham was absolutely desperate because he needed the money.
Yeah.
So we did do a second little mini series. It's got some funny bits in, and then stop that. And then what was good was that John was happy to work with us on movies.
Right.
So then we wrote The Holy Grail.
Did you all write it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was sort of that must have been a challenge to you had a story and you had to follow it.
We didn't have a story.
You didn't.
When you look at the first drafts of The Holy Grail, it's set in Harrods.
Yeah.
And people in the ant department and toupee department. So it's all over the place.
Right.
And then when we came back, we said, no, stop all that. It's got to be the story of King Arthur. It's got to be medieval. He's got to be looking for the Grail. You know, that gave us some kind of shape. But again, we still had various disparate things happening.
Yeah,
I had to put it into shape when I did Spamalot.
Yeah.
I finally made some sense out of it and put a shape on, because it's clearly the Seven Samurai. You get the guys together, you round them up, then you go on the quest.
Right.
You know? But the movie was in any bloody shape. You know, we moved it around a lot.
But Graham was consistent. You moved him through.
Graham was consistent, and we understand quest.
Yeah,
that'll do as the plot.
It's interesting how aware you all were of the, the characters, even if they were only for a minute or two, who would play them. Like, it seems like there was, how did that sort of happen? What did you guys cast each other, or was it, I made this and I'm doing this?
We always wrote first.
Yeah.
Finish the writing.
Uh-huh.
Finish the editing. So nobody could hang on to bits they loved because they were going to be in it.
Yeah.
So then we would cast.
Yeah.
And usually it's pretty obvious. You know, Cleese played the hard, arrogant, nasty people.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Terry Jones played the frumpy little women.
Yeah.
Graham played, sort of slightly bewildered people, like Brian and King Arthur.
Right.
And the rest of it would say Eric or Mike.
Yeah.
That's how we'd say. So because we played those little, middle class, working class people, we enjoyed playing.
Yeah, the doofuses, the enlightened doofuses.
Like, Eric or Mike.
What was Mike's bit in the grill where they're just playing in the dirt?
Yeah, he's in the mud.
Yeah.
Say, well, you could have called me. I didn't know. King comes along.
Yeah.
Oh, King, eh? Very nice. And who voted for you then? You don't vote for kings. Oh, charming. How did he become king? Well, the Lady of the Lake threw... Oh, nice. Moisten bins in ponds, throwing swords. It's no system for... basis for a system of government.
Right, right.
You know,
the enlightened
it's
guy.
It's terrific. It's wonderful stuff. It's really abuse.
Oh, did you have fun doing those things?
Writing, very much so,
yeah.
I think. I think the actual filming was always miserable because we were... up in Scotland and it was wet and damp and we didn't have enough money, but it was funny.
And then you guys did, it was the Ruddles after the Grail, it was, right?
After Python split up, I had my own TV series called Rutland Weekend Television.
Yeah.
And I did it with Neil Innes, and Neil would do a song or two a week.
Yeah.
And he would send me the tapes, and he sent me one and it was so Beatly.
Yeah.
And I suddenly had this thought of the Ruttles.
Yeah.
And I had this idea of the guy talking to camera and the camera moving away and him starting to run after it. And I thought, that's funny. And so we showed that on Saturday Night Live. And we had letters to the Ruttles.
Yeah.
And Lorne said, what are you doing? I said, I think I'm doing a documentary on these guys. He said, we'll do it for NBC.
Oh, and that's right. Yeah. I saw that. What was the title of the documentary?
All You Need Is Cash.
All You Need Is Cash.
And I did a sequel called Can't Buy Me Lunch.
Yeah.
Where I went around people like Tom Hanks and Gary Shandling.
Yeah.
And they talked about the influence of the Ruttles on their lives.
Yeah.
And Tom Hanks cried.
Oh, that's great.
Just brilliant. I mean, I would go around in my Mac as the interviewer and interview them.
Yeah.
And there was some brilliant stuff on that.
When did you start to feel, you know, along these lines? Because, yeah, I think out of all the crew, you know, America and you as a comedic personality seem to embrace each other. And the American comedic community, you sort of like you seem to be the most active in kind of like, you know, being the guy from Python who's like hanging out with Shandling, hanging out with these people. When did that start to happen? It must have been sort of an overwhelming amount of respect that came your way, and it must have been surprising initially.
It was very surprising. It happened in 74 when we first came and opened the Holy Grail, and we were trapped in the theater by 2,000 people coming with trying to get their coconut signed.
Yeah.
And then we met Belushi and people, Aykroyd.
What is 76?
75, 76. 70, yeah. And then I think I first did 76, I first did SNL. So I hosted it.
Like second season? Like
second season, second show.
Oh, wow.
And I, you know, I love comedy people.
Sure.
So it was fascinating to be in their world.
Yeah.
I think I hosted it four times in the '70s.
And what was it? What was the? Did it seem the writing process there compared to Python or what?
Yeah. The drug problem.
Yeah.
They would work on a Tuesday night and they'd smoke enormous amounts of marijuana in their offices. I mean, the idea that you'd have a joint at the BBC is unheard of. But they had all these offices barricaded off and they'd write all night.
Yeah.
And it was completely different than they'd never, because ours is a writer's commune.
Yeah.
The writers were in charge. The writers did everything. But theirs is much more of a performer's show.
Right.
And they would build the sets just on a pitch. And they said, whoa, this is... And they would never have time to rewrite, and you never had time to rehearse or learn it. You just read it off cards.
Yeah.
Because we would rehearse for 5 days, our Python shows.
Yeah.
So we were word perfect.
And you were also shooting on film, weren't you, a lot of the time?
We would go and shoot for all of the series on film. There were inserts throughout.
Yeah.
So we had to write the whole lot first.
Yeah, you can't just kind of do that the day
carefully
after.
Carefully planned.
Right.
Very carefully planned. Saturday Night was live.
You know,
it was this live vibe in the New York, and you know, quite different.
And who did you sort of gravitate towards when you, like, who'd you hang out with?
Oh, well, I love Gilda.
Yeah.
And I liked Aykroyd very much. He was the only one I thought could actually have been in Python, because he was a good writer and a great performer.
Yeah.
And he was very like what we did, which is writing and performing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Bill Murray came in.
That's so funny.
I hung with Chevy, who was hurt because he'd been Gerald Ford and was in bed.
Oh, really?
New York is great. It was just wonderful I've been through London for 10 years and now New York was a nice place to go
but to. I have to assume that they were like, just like, you know, when you got here, when Python got here, they're like, it was a completely new thing and completely different than anything that was happening in America, and it just sort of like, this is,
they were kind of fans when we first went along to the show. They were kind of like gobsmacked because it had just come on PBS as well as the movie opened, so it was a perfect storm in New York.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And where'd you meet Robin Williams?
I met Robin Williams in England, in London, in a nightclub. It's called a comic strip. It was the top of a strip club in 1980, and he'd been filming Popeye in Malta. Yeah. And somebody said, "You got to see this. You got
to
see this guy.
Oh, so you got
to meet him."
You went to see him perform.
I went to see him perform, and he just killed. And then we met, and then we went out to dinner, and you know,
and
it
he
was
moved
like
in
forever.
And then
I mean, I loved him. I mean, you can't believe anybody could be that quick.
But, yeah, it's a real loss, you know. But I guess, what do you know? I don't want to bring the whole interview down, but I miss him.
Well, he had a brain disease. It was Lewy body's disease.
It's terrible.
And I wondered, because when I knew him, I'd just follow him around all the nightclubs.
Yeah.
He and me would go out and he'd have enormous amounts of cocaine and go on the road, keep going on until about 4 a.m.
Yeah.
When he finally would seize up and no longer be funny.
Yeah.
Because of the dreaded white powder.
Yeah, yeah. You just
thank God we can go to bed now. But I wondered if eventually, because I'm
comedy hostage,
observing people have these brain problems, whether that in fact
helped it or caused it, or you know,
yes, yeah. I think we will find out that it's not very good for you.
I think that's true. I think that's what I tend to think that with MS as well. There are these neurological problems that come from.
I'm sure it's not good. No matter what, even if it's just cocaine, what else is chopped into it? You know what I mean? It's not
Right.
Really, it's going straight into your brain.
It's not like it's FDA approved.
Not yet. Yeah. I mean, this is California. You never know, you know.
And you were never a drug guy.
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? If it's, I'm English. I'll take anything that's going. You know what I mean? But I couldn't afford what he could afford. You know?
Right. So, after... Gilliam went on to do the amazing movies. You did a lot of those movies with him. You know, acted in a couple, right?
One.
Only just one.
One's just enough. Munchausen, yes.
Munchausen.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I don't know how he puts that shit together.
Oh, why?
Yeah.
It was 6 months of hell. I said I'd rather go back to boarding school than be back on that movie. It's complete chaos. But he is wonderful. I love him. But he only is happy when there's chaos.
He's one of those guys.
Oh, totally.
It's like the president.
He's an animator.
Yeah.
Do you trust Walt Disney?
Right.
No. They're moving bits and pieces around in their big pictures.
And they have complete control of it.
So if you're an actor
on
his show, you're just a bit in the scene. You know?
Right, right. Oh, right. So it doesn't matter if you're
there's
dangling
no human...
from something.
No.
Or yeah.
What do you mean you fell off? Don't fall off. I haven't got the shot yet.
But where did you find the time? I mean, this is what, your third book you wrote? But this one's a memoir. But you've written several books.
Yeah, this is... I wrote a tour diary called The Greedy Bastard Diary in about 2003 because I was on the road. But this is my autobiography because I'm getting to that age where you go, well, you better get it down now or you won't remember anything. And that's an issue.
You don't seem to be having any of those issues.
Well, but Jonesy's gone.
Yeah, mentally.
Alas. Yeah, he can't speak.
Oh.
And that's really sad. And so... You know, so I just, anyway, it's the 50th anniversary next year of Python.
Yeah.
So I thought, they're going to ask us questions. I better get my thoughts down.
So, yeah.
And I thought, this is a good time to reflect on the eve of that. And so I went off to France and I wrote and wrote and I would just, it's very good. I mean, I'm 75. It's a very good stage to look back at your life and think, what the fuck happened? Look at this.
Yeah.
How weird is that? And I was saying to my wife today, the first 25 years were preparing. And then we did Python when I was 26. And for 25 years, we did all of that.
Yeah.
The last 25 years, I came to America. I've been in America.
Yeah.
It's like three different portions of your life are quite different.
It's and that the 25 in America, you sort of adjusted to, you know, figuring out how to, you know, maintain your stature as a humorist and also function in show business very successfully.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of strange to be an immigrant at 50. You know, I mean, what am I going to do? But it was better than staying in England where they want to pigeonhole you.
Right.
And then finally we got to make Spamalot, which is really...
Yeah, how did... before we go on to that, in writing, because I've written a bit myself, did you find yourself, like, in the process of writing, like, discovering memories and being moved by...
Writing the book.
Yeah.
Yes. No,
it's kind of crazy, right?
I didn't... go to a publisher. I thought, I'm going to write the book for me. I want to know what I think and what I feel or what my life feels like to me, and then I'll sell it afterwards if they want it. But I don't want to find I'm overbooked to somebody.
Or have an editor on you and, you know, that kind of.
Before I knew what I wanted.
Yeah. And what were some of the things, like, in terms of looking back at your whole life, both for, you know, in darkness and light and whatever in history, you know, what were some of the things where you were like, oh my God, I really hadn't seen it that way?
I think what it became for me, I had to try and discover the subject of the book. And what it became for me, the subject of the book, was that generation. How odd that generation was coming out of war. I say always, when I was born, Hitler was trying to kill me.
Yeah.
And now my name's on Mars.
Yeah.
Because it's on Curiosity, the rover.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, whoa, excuse me?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
that's extraordinary because that arc is an amazing time.
Yeah,
and during which time our science has exploded, our knowledge of science of the universe, and what we've been able to do, people into the moon.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it is an extraordinary time. It's one of the benefits of peace.
Yeah, right. And now, isn't it sort of interesting that with all those advances and with that sort of hindsight, you know, from a real world war, that, you know, we are now entering, you know, these cultural tribalism again, and all this insanity, that the human animal, you know, is so significantly flawed that progress is not what everybody sees as a positive thing.
Yeah, I think it's sad. People don't know what war is. You see, I joke about the younger generation. They think a disaster is when they lose the internet connection. It's not people trying to bomb you.
Yeah.
But war is the really serious thing, and it goes on a lot on the planet.
Yeah, always.
And, you know, now we're getting people who divide us because for their own power, and that's awful.
But isn't it surprising, like, because, I mean, even, like, you don't talk about class much in America, but you know, when I really think about, you know, history, I mean, it's not surprising how stupid and easily led people are.
well, except they're fighting back. You see, television is very powerful, and people can talk, and the internet's very powerful, and they can fight back. I mean, who knew that it would be possible to subvert America by these idiotic bloody Russian KGB? Who knew they were? They're not that smart.
Yeah.
And also, they don't even have democracy, so it serves them kind of right.
Yeah.
But and they will lose because it's better off to be here than there.
Yeah. No matter what.
Yeah. So go fuck yourself.
For the
yourselves.
Time being. Yeah. Yeah. And do you think, like, did you also think about how, like, you know, the media landscape was much more intimate and smaller, you know, back when you were coming up, that, you could get all eyes upon you in a way over time. And now it's so fragmented that I wonder, it's hard to know how anybody becomes successful. It's usually not because of their creativity necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, there's many more famous people. Yeah. And the trouble is that America's gone from the pursuit of happiness to the pursuit of fame and money. Yeah. And they're not the same things at all.
That's true. And you seem to be pretty happy.
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very happy.
Yeah.
But I came and pursued happiness in America.
Yeah.
And I found it. Is it caught it.
Is it a choice, though, or you just find your... Do you battle anything? You know, like, are there days where you're like, ugh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it is... I mean, always look on the bright side. It's not a bad motto.
No.
But... I came here. I settled down here. I lived here. I put a child through school. I had a normal life.
How old's your kid?
She's now 28. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she went to college, and I loved all that. I loved taking a kid to school.
Your wife's American?
My wife's from Chicago. She's American. Yeah. And
spend time in Chicago?
Yeah.
It's great,
absolutely.
Right?
It's a great wonderful
city.
Town.
It's lovely. Great town.
We opened Spamalot there.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I picked it. They wanted to open in Boston and said, no bloody way. Chicago, the only place, because they don't give a thing about New York.
You can say
they
that.
Don't care.
Okay. Yeah.
But they, you know, they in Boston, they have a slight, you know, chip on their shoulder about New York, and they're always looking over their shoulder.
Yeah.
But Chicago, no, these are the people who don't wear shirts in the winter.
Oh, yeah, and they all smoke still.
Yeah, well, that's like the French. Nobody told the French.
And also, they have a pretty decent theater world in Chicago.
Totally.
Yeah.
A very good theater world, and they're just very funny people.
Did you assume that, you know, when, you know, what was the impetus, like, when you said, I'm going to make Spamalot, you know, where did the idea come from?
Well, we'd been looking. John Dupre and I had written a musical about cricket, which we'd done on Radio 4, and we were looking for a theme and a subject, and we were here. And I suddenly thought, well, actually, the Grail is a pretty amazing subject because it's like, it's a comic musical. It's a bit like the Ring of the Nibelungs. You know, it's the Arthurian legend.
Yeah.
See, you can take the large and then mock it as the small.
Right.
And also, because we had no horses, you can actually do it on stage.
Yeah.
And because it's sketchy, it keeps stopping and feels like it should be a song.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not dead yet.
Yeah.
It's always been a song, surely. Sure.
Yeah.
We just never got to write it until the musical.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and in terms of writing songs, like when you saw at the beginning of the book, you talk about always look on the bright side of life, and I had no idea that it had been recorded by so many different artists, and that, you know, it is sort of in the rotation of songs that people do at weddings and do at funerals
more largely.
Yeah.
Yes,
and that's true.
Number
that's
one
true
at
fact.
Funerals. It's
really?
A true fact. It's the number one song at funerals in the UK. which is kind of cute. I like that, don't you?
Yeah, it's amazing.
They don't pay.
Mm-hmm. No, I know.
But, you know.
It's sort of like happy birthday, you know. How are you going to monitor
it? No, they pay happy birthday.
No, I don't think so anymore. I think it got released into public domain recently. but they're not charging parties. There's no one making rounds.
It was seriously considered as the alternative national anthem in England. And so they sing it whenever they're losing, which is always great. And in fact, when the English were playing the Germans at football, and the Germans were losing in Berlin, whole of the German stadium sang Always Look on the Bright Side of Life in English.
Oh, that's amazing.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
I love that. And people say, Germans have no sense of humor. Rubbish. Bullshit. Listen, the English wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, exactly. You had a pretty long relationship with George Harrison.
Yeah.
Now, the Beatles thing is sort of, you know, what was your experience like knowing a Beatle? Yeah, because like when I interviewed Paul, I had very weird mixed feelings because there's nothing quite like the Beatles. There's like, you know, I said to him, I think we know Beatles songs prenatally for some reason, that there's a groove in our brains that just waiting for them to be put in.
And they were our generation, so we knew which album came next. And when it came, we'd run down and get the next Beatle album.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That changed the culture completely. Before then, people wouldn't have bought albums of rock and roll. So they were an extraordinary group, really creative.
Were you friends with all of them?
I know Ringo a little now. I see him quite a bit. I never met John. I've seen Paul a lot more recently, and he's awfully nice. He's really sweet. I mean, memorials and things. He say, "Come on, you need a hug." he's so wonderfully down to earth and such a genius songwriter.
He's funny too. He's very funny. Very
well, that was the secrets of the Beatles. They were funny.
Yeah.
When they came to America, everybody knew Ringo's name because he was funny.
Right.
He had a funny nose, funny haircut, and he was funny.
Yeah.
And that's what made the Beatles, I think, when they first hit America.
Yeah.
All those press conferences.
Sure, sure.
He's funny.
Yeah,
It's not that they sing a lot. They were hilarious.
And very identifiable personalities very quickly. They knew how to be themselves, you know, as opposed to be cryptic and weird and, you know,
they were being on the road since they were 14, you know.
It's
so
crazy.
Yeah. So they done it, and then, you know, it got very heavy for them, and the split-ups, and, you know, so it was interesting for me because I sort of studied it.
Yeah.
You know, to write the Ruttles, I had to learn everything about them and write them.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I even played Paul.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And that was quite interesting because Linda was very pro that. She loved it.
Oh, she did? She got a kick
Paul
out of it?
Paul was a little bit less, you know, keen on being...
Right.
But he's now nice about it.
Yeah. And George seemed to be a very spiritual guy all the way till, you know, the end, huh?
Well, no, George was always those two, both very naughty, the naughtiest boy in the room and the most spiritual boy in the room, too. He was both.
Yeah.
But he encouraged the Ruttles. I mean, he was behind it. He showed me all sorts of footage.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah. He showed me a film called The Long and Winding Road, which they could never agree to release because they couldn't agree... which bits to cut.
Mm-hmm.
They hated, some of them all hated at some bit or another, especially at the end, you know, the Let It Be tapes.
So
things.
It was really about the coming apart of the band?
But it never got released. So my film was a sort of parody of a film that never got released. And then they used all that material eventually when they did the 10-part anthology at the end of the 90s.
Yeah. And with your group, with your band, you guys toured, you know, a few years ago. Are you still in touch with Mike?
Yeah.
And John, and you are okay?
Yeah. We went on the roads for three tours, John and I, like 2 years ago. We had a wonderful time. We didn't tour. We did a final farewell show at the O2 in London in 2014.
Yeah.
And it was just in time because Jonesy was just losing his memory. And it was a final performance. We did 10 shows at O2, 18,000 people a night, sold out.
Yeah.
And it was good fun.
Yeah.
It was nice.
Yeah.
And we meet because we have a business, you know, we're business in common. We have to deal with business a bit.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
But
it's only like once a year we'll have to deal with it. But
sort out some numbers.
Well, it's like, what are we going to do? And everybody says, I don't do anything. All right, well, let's do that then.
Is it surprising to you that that Michael took a sort of non-comedic route in a way?
I think it's a sadness to me because he was really he was a comedian that got away.
Yeah.
And even now when he comes to visit me sometimes here, you'll look rather wistful.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, because he's one of the funniest performers.
So funny.
And
yeah,
he's such a funny writer.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's got him made his life as this sort of national treasure.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's famous. He'll be Sir Michael any minute.
Oh, yeah?
I hope they give it him next year. Yeah.
Are you sir? You're sir?
No.
Not yet?
Oh, no, no.
Why will he get it before you?
Well, he's already a CBE. He's worked his way up. He was an OBE, then CBE. You know, you have to be, where's the late in line? You have to be polite.
Yeah.
I'm not polite.
No, you, there's a line of progression.
Fact,
yeah.
Prince Charles asked me to be his jester one night in Scotland at Billy Connolly's because I was making him laugh.
Yeah.
And I said, why would I want a fucking awful job like that?
Was that even a job anymore?
I mean, no, of course it's not. But I mean, he laughed his ass off that I said, why would I want a fucking awful job like that?
Yeah.
Making you be your jester. Give me a break.
It's so you always hear about that there it was a job at one time.
But it's an important job because if Trump had a jester, he would be much healthier.
I don't think he has a sense of humor, really.
No, he doesn't. But the point is, the jesters are the ones that say the things you're not allowed to say.
Exactly.
They'll get your head cut off if you're an advisor.
Right.
But if you're a jester.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important in Shakespeare. You see that the role of the jester is to tell Henry VIII, you go and tell him.
Yeah.
Oh, no, we'll get the jester to tell him.
Yeah. Right, yeah, to tell the truth to the truth to power.
That's what comedy is.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, Trump could not, his ego could not handle a jester. So, you know, it's got to be on the shoulders of Colbert Maher. And
that's true, except
Kimmel.
He doesn't listen to them.
Yeah, no.
They're mocking
Some
him.
Some of them get through. Baldwin got through.
I think Sessions is his jester.
Oh, boy.
Man. He looks like a jester, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. They're all evil, though. There's no... It's just a bunch of evil clowns.
Isn't it awful? I think America's going to win. See, I have this firm belief in America because America saved us in 1943 when you all came over.
Seems like he might let the Russians just take over Europe if they want right now, though.
Well, that's what he wants,
yeah.
And that's what Putin wants. But I think America will win and throw him out. I think American institutions and Americans are true believers in freedom and liberty and will not put up with this.
Yeah, I hope you're...
On either side of the aisle.
Yeah.
You know, all the FBI people.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
They're Republicans. It's not the people he accuses of getting are all. So
yeah, I'll tell you what we're seeing, and I think you could see it in England too. Is that these politicians? You know, really, most of them stand for nothing but to proximity to power and, you know, honoring business interests. And it's sort of interesting how transparently craven this lot is.
I think the Russians have things on them. Because they
all
didn't.
Of them?
They didn't just tap the Democratic Party.
Right.
What would you do if the KGB?
I agree with that.
So I think Lindsey Graham. You can explain exactly.
I agree with that.
That they have things on all of them.
I think that's true.
Lindsey Graham, Paul Ryan.
I think
they've got big, you know, things on them.
And what do you make of Brexit?
I think it's the same thing. It was, but the Russians were behind it. Foul money came in and supported it. It's to disrupt Europe.
Yeah.
Which is what Putin's whole thing is.
Destabilize.
Maybe he can destabilize NATO at the same time.
Right.
So it was corrupt.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to vote, but I think it's a disaster.
Why weren't you allowed to vote?
Because I don't have a house in England.
Oh, but you're still a citizen.
I'm still a citizen. I can't vote in elections. I can't vote. I don't pay taxes. But anyway.
Has the feeling changed over there? Have you been there lately?
Well, don't forget, London was always very much Remain. London's the city with the most to lose. The city's having to flee because you can't run business operations. We were winning that game.
Yeah.
It's a totally insane policy.
Yeah. Oh, boy. We're going to see what's going to happen. That's for sure. And... So what's your... Are you
maybe.
Gonna, yeah.
I'll be in my nursing home, you know. Pass me my gin martini, would you?
You seem to have a pretty good attitude about mortality.
Yeah, well, that's from George.
Yeah?
Yeah, he was very, very strong. Remember, you're going to die. All this is going to go away. You can't... He was the most famous group in the world.
Yeah.
And he realized that it was all going to go away.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, his influence was both interesting and spiritual. I mean, he brought the whole Indian thing into the 60s.
Sure.
Single-handedly.
Yeah.
That's a guitarist from Liverpool.
And were you there, like, at the end?
Of his death?
Yeah.
Yeah, just after. I mean, I was visiting him during when he was the sick. Whole time.
And,
yeah.
And how was his disposition about it? Was he still fairly...
Very comfortable.
Really?
Yes, he felt that he was going to escape the pain of being rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very comfortable with the whole process of dying. And there were a lot of Indian things there, music. And,
uh-huh.
And so I'm going... Oh, I don't mind being reborn. I'll put my name down for that one, would you? So it was the only thing we ever disagreed on.
Uh-huh.
He accepted the fact that I didn't believe in anything.
Uh-huh.
And he, you know, he had been a Catholic and then he was a Hindu.
You know?
So, but he was always very generous spiritually.
Yeah.
Know? And that religion laughs at things a lot.
Sure.
Know? Like the Dalai Lama laughs all the time.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's a very kind of... The kind of nothing. I don't quite understand it, but it seems to be the most reasonable spiritual practice in terms of acceptance.
Realizing we're funny.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. That's the best thing.
Outside of ourselves, we're just funny. It may be tragic to us, but it's funny to other people.
That's true. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you have to have a sense of humor. We'd all be so depressed we wouldn't want to live.
I think it's a very useful, positive thing.
Yeah, when there's very little hope, at least there's relief.
But at least there's no war. People go, oh, no, there's very little hope. Look around. They've got, 52 channels of television. And
52? What, 900?
Yeah, exactly.
On my phone, I can.
Yeah, exactly. But the point is, nobody's bombing you yet.
Right.
And that, that's the important thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yet. And I hope it stays that way. It was great talking to you, man.
You too.
Thanks.
Thank you.
How was that? That was great. I'm so glad I got to talk to Eric Idle and to John Cleese. It was, I'm living a life, people, and it's pretty fucking amazing. Even with Sweaty Mark running around the streets of Lower Manhattan, he can stay there. He can stay there for eternity. But Mark right now is living an amazing life, and I'm grateful for that. Don't forget to grab a paperback copy of Waiting for the Punch wherever you get books or at markmaronbook.com, and I'll let you know what happens on set, if I can, within reason, within the limitations of what I'm allowed to talk about. Okay? Okay. Boomer lives! Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.